A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
I'm Matt Chorley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits, a brand new look for the Red Box podcast. It's all the same features, but now with my big fat face on the logo. On today's episode, every month we carry out a focus group exactly like the political parties to take the temperature of Britain. So today we take a look at a year in focus groups with former Number 10 pollster James Johnson. A really fascinating dive into how the language they use about Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer has changed. Before that, a little teaser of this week's episode of the How to Win an Election podcast. Peter Madison, Daniel Finkelstein and Polly McKenzie on the art of jokes. And if you like what you hear, you can join me for Politics Without the Boring Bits live on Times Radio, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. That's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. A big night in Westminster as Rishi Sunak invited lobby journalists in for drinks. He only stayed for half an hour, though, so I don't know, maybe he had a helicopter to catch. Before scarpering, he did confirm when the election is going to be. He said it will be next year. So that's something. Put that in your diaries. It means there won't be an election campaign over next Christmas, which is probably just as well, because Royal Mail wouldn't deliver any of the leaflets while they were prioritising parcels. Rishi Sunak also made what can only be described as some jokes. He said he'd been singing Christmas carols in Number 10, including, "O Come Tory Faithful," "I Saw Three Ships, Not On My Watch," and "Away in a Star Chamber." Yeah, he was doing "Away in a Star Chamber," Rishi Sunak. Really funny, really fun. Which reminds me that on Friday, we will be doing our annual 12 Days of Political Christmas. 12 Days of Political Christmas. So if you want to get in early with your suggestions, we want 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, 7. So, you know, five Tory families and all that. Email me, matt@times.radio, matt@times.radio, with your 12 Days of Political Christmas. And in fact, talking of jokes, that's the subject of this week's How to Win an Election.
People after the 97 election were turning up in reception trying to get paid.
Candidates are offering tea with Peter Mandelson.
Dinner with Tim Farron goes for less money.
Yes, here we go again then. It's How to Win an Election, your insider's guide to the huge political year ahead. I'm still Matt Chorley and I'm still joined by new Labour mastermind Peter Madison, Polly McKenzie, who's Director of Policy for Nick Clegg in the Coalition, and Tory brain box Daniel Finkelstein. Get in touch with all your questions and queries and complaints. You can email us howtowin@thetimes.co.uk. howtowin@thetimes.co.uk. Are we all well? All well?
Really well. So excited about Christmas.
Are you?
You sound weary, Matt, of being Matt Chorley, which worries me.
Yeah.
Well, there's a grim inevitability of it. That will continue. Right, so we're not going to be weary today. We're going to have fun today, because there is going to be a Boxing Day special bonus episode over the Christmas break. But we thought it is the period of cracker jokes, and there's an art to telling political jokes. And we've heard quite a lot recently, particularly from Keir Starmer.
The Prime Minister spent this week arguing about an ancient relic that only a tiny minority of the British public have any interest in. Mr. Speaker, that's enough about the Tory party.
So, Peter, does it matter that Keir Starmer tells terrible jokes?
I don't think he does tell terrible jokes. He's very amusing in private. He's always been a bit subdued, on the other hand, in public, and now he's sort of coming out, as it were. So I think that's very good news for everybody. And I think that to cheer people up at PMQs and tell a few jokes and mock the Prime Minister, I mean, what is there not to like?
Well, they have to be good, though, don't they?
Me too. I mean, I've been responsible,
you're so fussy,
I must admit, for quite a few poor jokes. A high spot for me was when Theresa May became Prime Minister. And
that was a high spot? What, for you personally?
There was a PMQ's joke. Please, mate.
A high spot for you.
It's like speaking German. I've got you know, my story's at the end of the sentence. Theresa May told a joke in her first Prime Minister's Questions, which was widely panned, and the Times decided it was going to do an article about how William Hague told these excellent jokes, and they rang me up so that I could say how excellent William Hague's jokes were by comparison with the joke she'd just told. The unfortunate thing was that I'd also written the joke she'd just told, the bad one, as well as the
what
other ones,
it?
And
the
I had to admit, I can't. It was about trains, and I cannot now remember it. A lot of joke telling, first of all, it's about the moment that you tell it. It's about how spontaneous it seems. It's about people's reaction to you, so that William Hague could tell a joke and it would work brilliantly. It would land brilliantly. Someone else would tell the same joke. It would land terribly because people weren't expecting to do it. If you're too obviously prepped for it, what might come out as a quip sounds terrible when it's prepared. That's what happened on this occasion.
Have you written any jokes for Rishi Sunak?
I'm not. The thing about joke telling, this is an interesting thing. There's an ethical thing, I think, here, because I was thinking about this before. You know, my view is that if I ever do provide jokes to politicians, generally
you
speaking...
You can't steal the authorship.
Yeah, generally speaking, it's for them. The only time I really objected, actually, was when the Sunday Times ran a story in which a number of William Hague's jokes, which actually were ones that I'd helped him with, were ascribed to someone else completely. My view is that after about 10 years, with the permission of the person involved, you probably can...
the statute of limitations.
Yeah, but at the time, you really can't. They're about helping somebody to make their speeches better and, make a point, get over with. And I do think they matter. In Prime Minister's Questions, it can matter a lot.
Polly, Ed Davey, funny man?
No. I mean, Ed is delightful. Kind, generous, sincere, but he's sort of so sincere. I don't know if you've noticed, he really furrows his brow when he speaks because he's painfully, painfully sincere. But I think Danny's onto something, because jokes sometimes work sort of primarily because of the context.
Right.
You know, politics is full of these weird contexts where jokes that are not funny can somehow work for sort of morale. That's certainly true in Prime Minister's Questions, where basically it's as if everyone's taken amphetamines and is sort of like jeery, jowly, like weird. And so they will do that, the call and response thing sometimes, you know, where it's like, I don't know, police numbers up, nurses up. And you just think, I'm so painfully embarrassed, right? But somehow there it works.
It sort of sounds like a joke. It's got all the component parts.
Robin Cook, by the way, just on the point that you're making, that's absolutely right, Polly. And I remember when Robin Cook went around a tour of different places and he kept on falling out with people, we worked on a joke for William
Hague. India and Pakistan.
Yes, so we worked on a joke, and I had the idea that we could say that he could create an ugly scene in a room by himself. That was vetoed on the grounds that it was mean. And so we at the end of the show, had no punchline. And we eventually said, well, look, let's just put, don't book it, Robin Cook it. It's not funny, but that's where the punchline goes.
Because we ran out of time. For younger listeners, it was Thomas Cook it.
Exactly. Yeah. We ran out of time. William just had to deliver that line. We didn't ever come up with a punchline. It brought the house down for exactly the reasons that Polly said. It was in the place where the punchline was supposed to go. People knew it was a punchline, so they laughed.
Now, I would say, that you're the representative of Ed Davey, but you have worked with him before. In fact, he was your first boss. I quite like his stupid stunts. The things he does, and because he does it with the air of...
That's because you worked on regional papers, right? Like
thin, you know, rather than taking himself too seriously, he's realised he leans into these things and he gets in the papers if he's opening a door or setting off a cannon. You know, they're visual jokes rather than, you know, verbal ones.
I think that's right. There's a sort of daytime TV vibe about them that works, but you wouldn't call them jokes, right?
No.
you just sort of cringe.
It's time to show Rishi Sunak the door while opening a blue door. It's quite good.
Well, yeah, but it's not.
Burst the bubble. Burst the balloon, burst the bubble, the Tory bubble.
It's funny because you can't believe they actually. No. They actually
I liked
did
the
it.
One when he drove through some blue hay bales in an orange digger. That was good.
I must say, Matt is very easily pleased, very easily amused.
We'll come in a minute to the question, you know, when you've been involved in these things. Does it make any difference that, you know, serious times, we're in serious times, serious economic times, serious global times. Do you think voters want a funny... Because, you know, Rishi Sunak, you wouldn't think, oh, if we invite the Sunaks and the Starmers around, we're going to have a right laugh at dinner, necessarily. Does that matter?
But that's not what the joke is for. Again, if you're talking about PMQs or you're talking about party conference, the joke is to build a sense of camaraderie and loyalty amongst your in-group. And then on those rare occasions that a joke really cuts through, it is because it says something that is in line with your actual kind of electoral strategy.
It's also aimed for the public. You want the public to nod along.
If it cuts through, but most
you want the man
don't.
And woman, the informed man and woman in the pub, to hear it and nod along and say, my God, he got that right. You know,
but it's because
it's not just for your own side.
No, but it's those cut-through jokes, right? It's because they are essentially a memorable soundbite, and they're more memorable because they're witty. Like Cameron saying to Blair, you know, he was the future once. It's not rolling in the aisles funny, but it lands on the message.
It's important also that it's mocking and not insulting.
Yeah.
And you want to deride your opponent. You don't want to rubbish your opponent because the man and woman in the pub won't like it. They won't nod along.
You want it also to demonstrate that the person that's telling it is witty, sharp, intelligent,
confident,
incisive,
yeah.
Confident. Richard Nixon is famously supposed to have said to Ted Sorensen, who was Kennedy's advisor, that he was really jealous of Kennedy's inaugural speech, which Sorensen had written. So Sorensen said to him, "You mean the bit 'ask not, you know, what you can do for your country'?" And Nixon says, "No, not that bit. The bit where he said, 'I do solemnly swear.'" Right? Very funny joke. Anyway, this was ascribed to Nixon, very witty Nixon. Odd, because Nixon really wasn't witty. Anyway, it turned out years later that Sorensen had just made that joke up. Nixon hadn't said anything of the sort, and he regretted it because it made Nixon look like he was, in fact, very funny. But in fact, Nixon, one of the characteristics of Nixon, he really wasn't. One of the reasons you do it is to demonstrate the person is, you know, got a really sharp sense of humour. But it can go wrong if they haven't and it looks terrible, or if the jokes are terrible themselves. I remember going to a party conference. You'll all have had this experience of people providing jokes from outside. I don't know whether you've had this, buddy, but I once was given a long list of jokes by Ken Dodd for William Hague's speech. They were all absolutely... the ones that weren't terrible, because they were, you know, obviously he's very funny, were just unusable politically because they were, you know, they made jokes that a politician couldn't
but
actually
they all just
use.
Diddy me not and all that business.
Were. And I'd Seb Coe agreed that he would go back to Ken Dodd and tell him that we couldn't use any of them. I didn't actually have to do that.
God, it's amazing. Because the other week we had Mike Batt from the Wombles, and it's extraordinary when you think this is going into the turn of the millennium.
So they, the Tories... The Tories have had, you know, Shirley Bassey, Jimmy Tarbuck at the time, certainly, I believe, you know, kind of Mike Reed, comedian.
And Let's Bomb Russia.
Kenny Everett. Whereas the Labour Party had sort of Billy Bragg, Paul Weller. It was like much cooler, but with smaller audiences, basically.
Smaller, I think, is generous.
I don't know about the Liberal Democrats. Did the Liberal Democrats have... Or the I suppose the Women's Equality Party did.
Well, yeah, that had Sandy Toksvig. But actually, the reason I had Sandy Toksvig's email address was because she had, on one occasion, provided Nick Clegg with a joke of some sort, along with some of the sort of behind-the-scenes news quiz type people. And you would also get lots of very peculiar people writing in with really quite lengthy jokes. And you know, most of them are terrible. But as I say, most of the time, especially for a party conference speech, it doesn't really matter because you've got to have something to add the light to the shade of the conference speech or it's boring. Much better if you can come up with a funny joke. But, you know, sometimes...
Sometimes you
can't. It's also good for morale as well.
Don't forget, you can catch the full episode of How to Win an Election wherever you're listening to this podcast. Up next, it's A Year in Focus Groups.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. And get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book host-read sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
The Big Thing.
Every month here on Times Radio, we carry out a focus group, exactly like the sort of focus groups the political parties are carrying out all the time. Now, I don't chair them, because I wouldn't know what I was doing. They're always chaired by James Johnson, now from JL Partners, but a former Downing Street pollster and focus grouper. So what we thought we'd do as we come to the end of 2023 is look back over how the views of voters have evolved from all the groups we've done, but also dig in a bit more to exactly what is the point of us doing this every month. Well, who better ask than James Johnson himself?
Hello.
James, let's start, as we always like to start, with our legal disclaimer. What is a focus group and what is not?
We should quiz viewers on this, Matt, get them to recite it. It's a focus group is a collection of people, 6 to 8 individuals. It's not meant to be representative. It's not a representative poll. It is a ability to dive deeper into the contours of the polling. What do people sort of say and think about underneath the opinions they're giving in the polls? And politicians love them because it allows them to test messages, work out in more detail how people are sort of talking and thinking and feeling, and really sort of get their sample of talking to normal people without having to necessarily do so themselves.
And in a more controlled way, I suppose, than what people are talking about, you know, in constituency surgeries, talking to their MPs or talking to journalists like me if I go out and vox pop in the street. You know, what you get is you get to mould the type of voter that you have in these groups.
Yeah, exactly. So I always remember that Brexit docudrama where, you know, Benedict Cumberbatch played Dominic Cummings a few years ago, and they had a focus group in that, you know, dramatised. And they had 6 people in there and they were all fighting because they all had massively different views. And I think they ended up almost coming to blows. It was a most inaccurate representation of a focus group. Sorry to be boring. But actually, focus groups are deliberately recruited to have people of similar views. And the reason is because you don't want to spend 90 minutes having a bus stop. You know, you want to dig deeper into that particular group. Now, they might have disagreements on specifics, but it is designed as that deeper dive. And then the second thing that makes them different from an MP going and knocking on the doors or whatever is that the focus group respondents, when they sort of sign up, they are not necessarily told who it's for. And obviously, political parties, they can go in, they can do a market research exercise without giving away that it's the Tories or the Labour listening to them and trying to find out what they think.
All right, so give us some examples then of the sort of real life examples of where either a message has been tested in a focus group, which has then become a real thing, you know, and lots of things that people say in focus groups then end up in messaging. So from your time working in politics, give us some examples of how focus groups have played that part.
Yeah, well, my favourite example is quite early on in the Theresa May premiership when she was trying to work out how to respond to Nicola Sturgeon trying to go for a second independence referendum. And I was dispatched up to Glasgow to talk to voters who were basically pro-independence, but not necessarily pro a second referendum. And we dug into why that was. And firstly, it was a really good example of how focus groups work, because there were lots of sort of pre-concocted messages that Number 10 and the Conservative Party had drawn up that we tested. But actually, the one what really worked was something that came up naturally in the group, which was this frustration that the SNP were focusing on independence rather than on public services and schools and the NHS, etc., in Scotland itself. So that's warning number one, is, you know, focus groups, by just going and listening, they tell you more than someone drawing up messages in Number 10 or a boardroom or wherever would be able to come up with. And number two, in terms of the real life impact in that Glaswegian front room, once they'd got over taking the mick out of my accent, one person said to me, "Nicola Sturgeon, she just has tunnel vision. She has tunnel vision. She's only focused on independence, nothing else." And I always think the chap in that focus group who said that must have been quite bewildered the next day, because Theresa May had a speech lined up and she said, "Nicola Sturgeon has tunnel vision."
The tunnel vision that the SNP has shown today is deeply regrettable. It sets Scotland on a course for more uncertainty and division, creating huge uncertainty. And this is at a time when the evidence is that the Scottish people, majority of the Scottish people, do not want a second independence referendum.
And that ended up leading the bulletins. In fact, it was the top story on BBC News. So now, focus groups are not always so literal, but that is an example where, you know, the messaging reflected in the reality.
And we've seen that in lots of ways. You know, with Get Brexit Done was born out of the fact that people kept saying, "Just get it done, just stop talking about it." And the beauty of that, I suppose, is that it's a phrase that a normal person has said just in conversation. So it's going to sound more realistic than the sort of thing that might be drawn up by, you know, clever people with flip charts. And before you know it, you've got a sort of gobbledygook of Britain's stronger economy in a place in a Europe, you know,
yeah,
sort of thing. It's just a sort of buzzword like salad. Whereas actually, if you can capture what you want to capture in any political messaging, is to sound like you've just thought of it. And actually using the language of normal people is a really important way of doing that. Okay, right, let's jump in then to some of the focus groups that we've had this year and the evolution of the way that normal people have been talking about politics. Now, we should stress, obviously, they are different people in different groups. The group we had in January is different to the group we had in June, which is different to the group in November. And then there are also different types of voters. There are sometimes people who voted Tory and Labour in 2019 and now say they're undecided. Sometimes it's that they voted Tory last time and now they've switched to Labour. You know, one month we did people who were in favour of the SNP but weren't sure about another independence referendum. So it's always different groups. But this is just quite an interesting way to sort of take a temperature test once a month, see what people are actually saying about politics. So let's go back then to the first group we had way back in January. What were they saying about Rishi Sunak?
He's came in into a sinking ship, essentially. And I've got no reason to not trust him, really.
He's inherited a mess. If it's a year to the next election, he's got a time to put a mandate, plan and strategy together.
There is a plan. I can trust him on that.
Nothing massive against Rishi at the minute, but I think seatbelting, you know, not necessarily being totally honest about certain things.
You know, it's what's so great about this is that it takes us back to a political time that's quite hard to remember, even though it was the beginning of the year. It's a completely different political mood. So that group was in January. And a reminder of that sense of the benefit of the doubt. He'd picked up at a really hard time. I think, you know, even in those, that group later on said, well, look, he might be rich, but that means he's not in it for the money, he's doing it for the right reasons. They were sort of wishing him well while being not terribly convinced by Keir Starmer.
Yeah, absolutely. And goodness, a bit of a blast in the past there about referencing the seatbelt, which I think referred to Rishi Sunak not wearing a seatbelt in a clip. I think that'd be the least of his worries now. Yeah, look, that was around the time at the start of the year of that Five Pledges speech, where Rishi Sunak set out his plan. And although it took a while for the Five Pledges to sink in, you know, that generated this feeling that perhaps this was the serious new man on the block.
Okay, so that was January. Let's jump then to our most recent group, literally just right at the end of last month. Again, it's obviously a different group of people, but selected somewhere. Some were people who voted Tories, now switched to Labour, others undecided. So this is what our focus group was saying about Rishi Sunak in November.
Failed.
Meek. Money. Upper class.
Out of touch, uninspiring and inconsistent.
Fence-sitting appeaser.
Bit of a letdown from what I were expecting.
Nothing positive in November, having been quite warm towards him. You know, there was clearly a window of opportunity there for Rishi Sunak back in January.
Yeah. At the core of this is that if you set out in January, Five Pledges you're going to deliver by December, and then only deliver one of them, this is where opinion ends up. But there's other things happening as well, and I think the main thing there is weak fence sitter. They don't feel like Rishi Sunak is present and that he is standing up for Britain or the British people at the right moments. And there are a few moments in the year that crystallised that for people. One of them was, you know, during the pro-Palestine protests on Remembrance Weekend. PM wasn't there, wasn't seen to be present. They didn't necessarily want him to ban marches or anything, but they wanted that bit of leadership. So I think that's a huge issue for Rishi Sunak, that weakness thing. Because once people start thinking you're weak, then they start, you know, thinking that you can't get anything done for them. And that's what's getting him. It's weakness and delivery. And there's one more thing as well, Matt, which is background. Now, I think this is absolutely crucial because, as we heard in January, people are not necessarily anti a politician because they're rich. They had all the same facts about Rishi Sunak's wealth in January as they do now in December. But they went from saying it's neutral, even potentially a positive, because he's in it for the right reasons, to now saying it's a negative. Why is that? Well, I think it's one of those things where wealth only matters when it matters. Once people have taken a negative view of you, then it gets added to the list of bad things. It's like Boris Johnson's wallpaper, remember that? I remember our focus groups in 2021. No one cared about the wallpaper. Come 2022, they all started bringing it up once they'd lost faith in Boris Johnson over Partygate. Rishi Sunak's wealth is his Boris's wallpaper, and that is very dangerous for him. And the one that comes up a lot now, Matt, that we didn't hear so much at the time, was this time last year when Rishi Sunak did that Christmas Eve visit to a homeless shelter. And he was chatting to the homeless chap, and I think he said something like, have you considered, you know, work in the city or something? That didn't really come up at the time. But as late as October in our focus groups, people were talking about that.
Yeah, it's really interesting as well, just what sort of resurfaces in people's minds. It goes in there and then it takes a while to come back up again. I suppose also as well, social media means that things get dredged up after the event. James, we've looked at how the voters were talking about Rishi Sunak over the course of 2023 and how that sort of the way they were talking about it is sort of deteriorated over the months. Let's then look at the way they were talking about Keir Starmer and see, you know, has that gone in the opposite direction, as you might think if you've been looking at the opinion polls and so on. So let's go all the way back to January then and see what the January focus group here on Times Radio was saying about Keir Starmer.
I think he will always tell us what we want to hear.
I don't know if it's just he's got one of those faces I don't really trust.
If the Tories make mistakes, he's straight on it. But he doesn't seem to have any ideas of his own. There's just something about him that I just don't like, and I can't put my finger on what it is.
He has got one of those faces that, you know, it's not quite warming, but he has actually grown on there.
Oh, yeah, I remember this group, because lots of listeners took exception to this focus on Keir Starmer's face. They also always should be focusing on, you know, important things, policies and principles and the direction of the country. But, you know, it goes back to the thing we were discussing before with, you know, Rishi Sunak. You know, normal people don't spend very long thinking about politics. So, you know, whether or not they think, that's a man I could trust, that's a woman who does what she says she's going to do, those are real quick-fire judgments that are made, and they end up informing a lot about how some people will vote.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know what it is about Keir Starmer's face, but there is this sense of untrustworthiness, and we get that a lot in the groups, don't we? I mean, we get people responding on Twitter saying, yeah, slimy, slippery, smarmy, this is a bit harsh, isn't it? But that is the sense that they have generated of Keir Starmer, including at the start of the year.
Okay, then. So then let's jump ahead. This is a focus group we heard from in June when James asked them to sum up Keir Starmer in a word.
Fresh, new.
Talks the talk, but can he do the walk?
I don't know who it is.
I'll just say hopeful.
I don't know an awful lot about him.
I don't really know much about him.
I mean, this is amazing, James. I mean, I didn't actually realise it was still, even as recently as June, we were getting people saying they didn't know who Keir Starmer was, despite he's been around, in the job for more than three and a half years by that point. A reminder again, I suppose, that most people are not following politics as closely as we are, and it's the job of the leader of the opposition to get up every day and pretend that today is day one all over again.
Yeah, and Keir Starmer, for many voters, will still has his day one to come. And that will probably be the general election campaign. So that's a really good, it's pretty good news if you're Keir Starmer, because those who do know who he is tend to have generated a negative view. So he will be hoping to have that sort of reintroduction moment to the electorate, and indeed the first introduction for many others. So that don't know factor is really important. What I would say, though, is that there are also many voters who have been aware of what Keir Starmer's been saying and are aware that he's been around for some time, and they've taken a pretty hostile view of him. And that feels a bit more locked in than perhaps it might have for other Labour leaders in the past.
Okay, now let's jump to the group we did last month to get their assessment of Keir Starmer again. I think this was a group, half had voted Tory, half voted Labour in 2019. Some of them were Tories who now said they were undecided, and some had switched to Labour. So they're exactly the sort of voters the Tories need to get back, but Keir Starmer needs to hold on to.
Just seems very slimy and was underhanded.
He seems to want to be something for everyone, which you just can't be. You can't make everyone happy.
I just don't feel with Starmer, I could trust what he says. I'm not sure about his principles.
It's just all fair coat and no knickers sort of thing. He talks a good talk, but I worry about the rigour of what he's promising.
That group, I think about half of them had said they were voting Labour, James. So I suppose that speaks to the problem that you were saying, that actually people not knowing who you are might sometimes be better than people who do know who you are but have taken against you.
Yeah, and there's a few things in there. The first is this sense that he flip-flops, that he says one thing and then does the other. Now, that is different from, say, voters' views of Ed Miliband, where they said he flip-flops because he's weak and he's just a bit of a sort of damp rag and, you know, he doesn't really know what he stands for. With Starmer, it's different. They think it's more calculated. They think he's doing it just to get into power. Boris Johnson's famous Captain Hindsight moniker might be Boris Johnson's best legacy to the Conservative Party. There might not be many of them, but he's certainly got that, because that sense that Keir Starmer also did this in the pandemic in particular comes up again and again and again. Look, you can see what the number 10 strategy was at the start of the year. You know, deliver on the five pledges. Contrast to Keir Starmer, who hasn't got this sort of steady sense of purpose to him or the ability to get things done. Now, number 10 will be hoping that these concerns about Keir Starmer really manifest in an election campaign, even despite the failure to deliver on the five pledges. And they may well do, but there's two big reasons to be cautious that these necessarily spell the end for Keir Starmer. One is change. And we've had many voters diss Rishi Sunak at the start of a group, diss Keir Starmer even more at the middle of the group, and then by the end of the group saying, oh yeah, I'm still going Labour though because it's time for change. And that's key.
And I suppose, ultimately, if you look at the headline polls, you know, Labour ahead by, what, 15, 20 points. It's clear that even if people are doing it, you know, saying, I can't stand the man, he's slimy, I don't like his face, or whatever it might be, a lot of people are currently saying they're going to put a vote in the box for the Labour candidate, which it looks like is going to deliver Keir Starmer a decent-sized majority.
Yeah, and then that's the second thing. He's not that scary. He might be a bit slippery and a bit, you know, oh, don't like him that much, but he's not seen as a major barrier to them as Corbyn was by the time of the 2019 election. But look, listening to our focus groups, Matt, you know, I think it does temper that talk about landslide elections for Labour. I think, what we can certainly see under the skin of everything is that this is going to be a very lukewarm election, whatever happens. Perhaps not as bad as the Trump-Biden face-off in America, but voters are not excited by this one.
Just finally, James, I'm interested in that evolution of the it's time for a change message. I've got two more clips to play to you. One is again from that group in January, where you're asking, are Labour ready to take over? And then we'll hear from a group in July. So first of all, this is the group from January.
I don't think they are ready. I think they would go in with all these great ideas, but I don't think they would be prepared for what it would all entail. And I do think Rishi is a man with a plan.
I think kind of need to fix the mess first and then they could potentially step in. But I don't think it's the right time.
Basically, for me, I think anyone's better than Conservatives at the minute.
There's no plan or strategy. I can't see it. The only strategy seems to be to knock the Conservatives at the minute rather than this is what we're going to do to put the country right.
So that was the group in January. In that sense of Rishi Sunak as a man with a plan. But, you know, going back to the point you were making earlier on, James, he had just set out his five pledges. He was new in the job, explaining what he was going to do in a way that maybe people felt that Labour hadn't. So now let's jump to the focus group in July.
I think it's time for a change. I think people have had enough of, like, the current government.
I think it's time for a change again.
I don't particularly like Keir Starmer as a leader, and I think he's the wrong fit for Labour. But I do think that Conservatives need a shake-up. They need a wake-up call.
So actually, James, I suppose that group from July sums up exactly the mood you were talking about, that ultimately a lot of people in the end are going to vote Labour because the time for change message, I mean, it's such a brilliant phrase because it chips off the tongue. People say it in just normal conversation. And it's basically Labour's and every incoming government's election strategy.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can sort of hear the ghost of Gordon Brown in some of that. You know, we get this a lot, a sense that Labour perhaps messed it up last time, so can they be trusted again, especially on the economy? Do they have the readiness? Do they have the numbers? Do they have the sums to know to work all this out? But it also speaks to the wasted opportunity by the Conservative Party there. I think when you listen to these groups, if you're a Conservative listening to these groups, you must be sitting there and thinking, my God, this is so winnable. And this is so winnable. You know, people don't like Keir Starmer. Goodness me, why are we 20 points behind? And the answer is that you can make changes on legal immigration, you can introduce tax cuts, but if your party and leader doesn't have that confidence of the public, then all the giveaways in the world won't make a difference. So take the legal immigration announcement. Now, obviously, it was overshadowed by the massive own goal on Miranda on the Wednesday, but when that was announced on the Monday, James Cleverly fronted the announcement rather than the Prime Minister. Yeah, that almost stopped it from getting the headlines and association with the PM that they could have had. Take the taxes, the income tax cut. I think most people will have forgotten that by now. It wasn't necessarily associated with a strong message and drum roll by the Prime Minister. So the voter of 2024 is very different from the voter of, say, 2010. You know, if we remember Cameron Clegg, Gordon Brown lining up at those TV debates 13 years ago, competence was the order of the day. Who can manage things best? Now, in 2024, it is about strength, says what you mean, and gets things done. And Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer have to embody that to really make a connection with the voters. And I will say one more thing, Matt, that could upset all of this dynamic that we've been speaking about. The man from the jungle. You can hear in these groups, there is a desperate urge for another option. And it's probably not going to be the Lib Dems, the Greens aren't really on the field, but we are seeing Reform UK creep up in the polls. Now, whether Nigel Farage allies with those or just sort of keeps his powder dry for after the election, he could have a big impact on voters like this who are, frankly, fed up with everyone.
Yeah. In reality, though, is it not the case that Reform just takes more voters away from the Tories, which actually just makes a Labour win bigger because it means the Tories are losing to both wings, if you like?
Yeah, I think certainly Reform UK takes more votes from the Tories than Labour. Having said all that, that's what everybody thought ahead of the 2015 general election. And it actually ended up that people who would have gone from Tory to Labour were actually going Tory to UKIP instead. And you might see a similar thing happening there. Remember, if you're Keir Starmer, you really want to get these Labour to Tory switchers back at this election because you don't want to lose them for good. You know, you don't want them to sever their relationship with Labour. So you're absolutely right. Reform UK would hurt the Tories more. But for Labour's even medium-term, long-term plans, they want to kiss and make up with the voters of the Red Wall who abandoned them rather than see them drift off to another partner in Nigel Farage.
All right then, James, we're coming to the end of the year. You know, New Year's resolutions, New Year predictions and all of that. When's the election going to be?
Oh, goodness me. People have to pay me for that insight, Matt. I am of the view that we're going to be later in the year because I just don't think governments who are 20 points behind decide to go early. Rishi Sunak is many things. I don't think he's a gambling man, and I think he will be waiting until at the end of the year.
Well, that's just, you know, that's just plenty more reason for us to carry on doing our focus groups well into 2024 as well. James Johnson, lovely to see you. James, of course, at JL Partners now, former number 10 pollster for Theresa May, and look forward to doing it all again next year. James, happy Christmas.
Happy Christmas to you, Matt. Love it. Looking forward to a very happy focus group 2024.
Thank you for listening to Politics Without the Boring Bits. Don't forget you can get in touch by emailing me, matt@times.radio. If there's anything you want us to do more or less of on the podcast, let us know. But for now, for me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional unprofessionals, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.